It's 9 a.m. on Wednesday, June 20th, 2017, in the San Francisco International Airport. New York Times tech journalist Mike Isaac sits at the Virgin American terminal waiting. He's about to board a plane to Los Angeles to conduct an onstage interview at a tech conference. As he waits for the gate agent to start the boarding process, Mike checks his phone. It's one of his main sources at Uber, so Mike picks up. "Hey man, I'm about to get on a plane. Can we talk later?"
No, we need to talk now, trust me. "Where are you?"
"At the airport."
"Where the hell are you going?"
"LA, tech conference."
"Blow it off."
"What's going on?"
"You remember our conversation this past weekend?"
The source called Mike over the weekend and gave him a tip. Travis Kalanick is about to be fired. Mike gets tips all the time, and most of them don't amount to much. But this particular fact had the ring of authenticity. For months, Uber had been at the center of a long list of scandals, many personally involving Uber CEO Travis Kalanick. Many employees at Uber have openly called for Travis's resignation. And Travis's position wasn't improved by the damning Holder report released earlier in the month. "Well, do you have anything concrete?"
"It's happening, Mike. Travis is going to go, and it's real soon."
"Well, how soon is soon?"
"It's going down today."
Today? Are you serious?"
"Dead serious. Be by your computer and keep your phone on all day. I'll call you."
It was Mike Isaac's job to cover the tech world in Silicon Valley. He had been writing about Uber for years, and he had many sources inside Uber, and he used them to expose some of the company's darkest secrets. He had always been an observer of the story of Uber's rise and Travis Kalanick's demise. But in June of 2017, Mike went from being an observer to a participant. He would find himself caught in the middle of a battle between Travis Kalanick and his opponents. Travis's foes would use Mike as a piece of leverage and wield him as a weapon to strike out at Travis.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great-tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great-tasting, high-quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is Business Movers. Mike Isaac is a technology reporter for the New York Times and author of the best-selling book Super Pumped, The Battle for Uber, now available in paperback. Mike has covered Silicon Valley for years, but in this particular story, Mike's more than just a reporter. He became an accidental character. During his time covering Uber, Mike was unwittingly pulled into the plot. He found himself caught in the middle of a power struggle between Travis Kalanick and what Mike described as a syndicate of Uber investors who were determined to drive Travis out of the company he helped create. Here's our conversation. Mike Isaac, welcome to Business Movers.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So the title of your book, Super Pumped, it comes from Travis Kalanick's 14 principles, and they were inspired by Jeff Bezos and unveiled at the infamous X to the X party in Las Vegas. Why choose that phrase as the title of your book? It certainly meant something to Travis, but what did it come to mean to you?
Yeah, so I agonized over the title for some time just because I wanted to try to get the right mix of something that felt like a phrase that embodied what startup culture means to a lot of folks that worked at Uber and that work at in the Valley in general, but also kind of a tongue-in-cheek knowing nod to how absurd some of it is, I guess is what I would say. Basically, I called Travis's 14 principles, like running Jeff Bezos's 14 principles through like a bro speak translator. So like Super Pumped being one of them where they're happy to take on the world, but also just not self-aware enough to know how kind of cheesy it is. Always Be Hustling. I almost called the book Always Be Hustling. That was another potential title, but just sort of this idea that they are these sort of startup bro mentality, but not quite at the point where they were self-aware enough to sort of not take themselves so seriously.
So there's definitely in the Uber story, it's centered around this bro culture that we're trying to identify here. And it takes on its own language, like Super Pumped or Always Be Hustling. It is something removed from what perhaps the rest of the world views it as. How did you first learn about what was happening behind the scenes at Uber? Certainly, the X at the X party was a big reveal about how extreme and aggressive Uber was. But what were your first whiffs?
Yeah, well, I tell sort of sources a lot of the time that, you know, leaks don't happen at a functional, normal company where everything is going great. They really start happening when things start going off the rails, and they're more of a symptom of a larger dysfunction at the time rather than the problem itself. So I would say around 2016, 2017, you know, Uber has always been controversial. Travis Kalanick has always been sort of like outwardly bro-ish, stuck his foot in his mouth, and really garnered the ire of, you know, the press and some of the public for a long period of time. But in 2016, 2017 is when that internal culture, I think, started going south, and the company swelled to, you know, thousands of employees. But, you know, normally once your company gets to a big enough size, you might kind of stop acting like a scrappy startup and stop acting like you're the underdog. And Uber just didn't. They sort of facilitated and really supported this idea that killer be killed internally was good. You know, one tenet they had was toe stepping. So like intentionally stepping on the toes of other people inside, really like pitting people against each other in ways that I think now are kind of having a reckoning in some different workplaces across the States, if not the world. But people started really being upset at these things like the X to the X party, where they would steal a party bus or hire, you know, sex workers, or doing drugs at this insane club party where Beyonce made a special appearance. So I think it started going south around then. And that's when more people started coming and talking to me saying, hey, you need to look into Uber because something is not right here.
Well, quickly, why were you the person to come talk to? Where were you in San Francisco and what were you doing?
Yeah. So I've been at the Times for 6.5 years now. I had actually been covering Uber since 2014 when Travis started kind of putting his foot in his mouth and making kind of sexist comments initially to the press, you know, openly without really fearing the backlash. And so I had always been interested in Uber, particularly because Travis is such an outsized personality, and you know, I think a lot of the story focuses around the characters in some of these companies, and Travis is quite a character. And I had written a larger piece around the sort of implosion of the culture internally at Uber, and in journalism, stories lead to more stories, basically. And so a lot of sources kind of saw that and started seeking me out, and then it just sort of builds upon itself. So in part, I would say it's because, you know, being at the Times, you have an advantage, I would say, when sources want to get something written about, they can go to you at the Times. And then just sort of a momentum carried after that, after the paper really supported me in aggressively covering the company over 2017.
So your story about the X to the X party in particular, it mm-hmm. came out just a few days after Susan Fowler told her horrific experience at Uber. Were you aware of Susan Fowler at the time? Did her story alter the trajectory of your reporting?
Oh, man, absolutely. I think Susan Fowler's story really was, I think, the breaking point for a lot of people. There was a sort of internal tension, internal feeling that not everything was good, even if everyone couldn't put a voice to it or knew how to express it. And then this former employee, this woman, Susan Fowler, an engineer, basically does this couple thousand word blog post laying out her detailed experience of harassment at the hands of her boss, sort of misogyny throughout different departments, feeling discriminated against, feeling marginalized, and really put it out there plainly for everyone to see in a way that I don't think had been enunciated by anyone at the company yet, you know, for a number of reasons, for not wanting to be persecuted, for not wanting to lose out on a big payday, or for not feeling safe in doing that. And once that happened, the dam really broke. And I started asking around. A few of my sources from the company said, you need to look at this blog as it came out, because it had been circulating internally and people have way more things to say about it. So I really find that once the dam breaks on things like this, and there's a lot of sort of bodies buried, then they start coming out and all at once. It's like a little bit in the beginning and then all at once.
Well, yeah, that February certainly was an instance of all at once. We had Susan Fowler's blog. We had your story, the Fozzie Camel video. This is a bit of a sea change. This is the tremor that might foretell a big fall. What was the feeling behind around Silicon Valley? Did you think Travis was in trouble?
You know, it's funny because I think over the past few years, we've been doing a lot of thinking about tech coverage from, let's say, the early aughts to throughout 2010 through 2012. And I think a lot of early tech coverage was sort of praising, you know, wide-eyed sort of founder stories, praising this idea of a young man coding in his dorm room and creating the next billion-dollar company. I think early coverage of Uber, a lot of mainstream coverage, was really enamored with the idea that Uber was this mega unicorn, right? There had not been a company worth as much as Uber as a privately valued tech company since Facebook. And there was, you know, talk of it perhaps surpassing Facebook's sort of value as a private company before going public. Every time they raised a new round of venture capital, it was just another $100 million or another $1 billion in their war chest. It really felt like a sense of inevitability around Uber and around Travis as this next powerful CEO. And then, you know, when the dam broke in 2017, when you had Susan Fowler and this cult of misogyny and sexism inside of the company, when you had potentially law-breaking behaviors that started arising, when you had Travis's video of him berating the driver, you know, in full view of the internet to see, I think it was the first sense of, is Uber really in trouble? Can this company, one of the most valuable, privately valued companies in the world, will this go to zero? And will the CEO essentially be expelled? So I think that was absolutely when people started wondering if that was going to happen. And more sort of came out. And the history of enemies that Travis had made along the way started really coming out of the woodwork too.
Well, some of the enemies that he made were his own employees. Because right on the heels of the Fozzie Camel video, you got a phone call from an Uber employee with a pretty big story to tell. But whistleblowers like Bob have all sorts of motivations. You know, they're from noble to petty. So without revealing anything, what can you tell us about Bob and his motivations? What was going on inside Uber that was driving people to leak stories, risking enormous retaliation?
Yeah, so I think it's a totally fair question. I think just in journalism in general, you always have to weigh what someone is telling you and why they're telling you it and why they're telling you it now, basically. And so, you know, an old journalistic maxim is like, if your mother tells you something, you need to check it out, basically. So you don't just sort of take one person's word as gospel. But I had this this person come to me, when I call them Bob in the book, and they essentially lay out a sort of history of potentially illegal behavior by the company, ways of skirting local transportation laws, local police and transportation officials in how they moved into new cities, not just domestically, but internationally as well, really in countries around the world. And they devised this system of doing it so that they essentially made a playbook for it and anyone could do it and hit the ground running. It's one of those things as a journalist, when they lay it out to you, it seems a little like too perfect of a clean story and narrative to be true, seems a little too devious. So I definitely had to go check with one or two other reliable sources that I had just to make sure if this was a real thing or if this was a employee with a vendetta or something like that. But I think one thing you can also do is, yes, people have all different kinds of motivations to share information with you. Yes, maybe they are mad at the company, but they can still also have truth to it. And I think your job as a journalist, my job as a journalist, is to suss out what that truth is and what the framing and the real story is, and get a mix of input and sources to do that. And so, yeah, I mean, in the end, for this particular story, for what this software tool called Grayball, I eventually confronted Uber with it, and they didn't have a really great defense. They basically said, you know, kind of were caught with their hand in the cookie jar of of illicit moves in business. And so they basically just sort of backed off the practice over time. But I think it's totally fair to weigh motivations, and essentially just my answer to that is usually get a broader array of sources and try to get as fair a story as possible.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
In the course of reporting the story, and it's, you know, over the span of years, you're getting these leaks and you're finding your characters and validating your sources. But you were not just an observer of Travis Kalanick's downfall. In a certain sense, you became a character in the saga. Talking about the norms of journalism, that's got to be an uncomfortable position for a journalist, to become part of the story you're reporting. How did that happen?
It's really interesting because I feel like journalism is you know, has evolved and changed a lot over the past, let's say, 5 to 10 years. That voiciness, traditionally, when you become a journalist, they're like, you eliminate yourself from the story. You are not the story. Your voice should be gone. And, you know, people just want to know what the news is or whatever, right? I think that actually is changing now. I think major publications are finding that people like voices or personalities around some people, and that slowly started to move in a different direction. I think there's like some tenets that you can't do away with. You have to always have a sort of fair, objective basis of where the reporting starts, but maybe add your own analysis. So anyway, that's where I come into this, where I'm just like, all right, I don't love Uber. I don't hate Uber. I'm agnostic here. I'm just sort of aggressively reporting on the company. But eventually, at the top of the company, at the board level, at the executive level, when things got bad enough, people started turning on each other. And executives started seeing each other as sort of liabilities. Travis refused to step down from the company, even though it was very clear to a lot of people that he needed to go. And so the plan by a sort of small cabal of board members and investors was to essentially go to Travis and say, look, we want your resignation by the end of the day. This was in Chicago in 2017 in summer. Go to them and say, we want your resignation by the end of the day, or we're going to leak this whole story to the New York Times, to Mike, who has been reporting on this aggressively, and basically stage an investor coup to force you out of this. And little did I know that I was sort of slowly being fed information just in case this was going to happen. But unbeknownst to me, I did not know I was being used as sort of a threat or leverage to get him to step down from the company. So it's this weird position where I think journalists are aware they're being used a lot of the time. I think you have to go into it knowing what, you know, the ethical compass is and sticking to the news and the facts without having a side in it or a dog in the fight, I think is really crucial. Some of this stuff doesn't come without the ability of hindsight. And so when I was reporting out this book, I later found out, you know, how they approached me and what they were sort of promising Travis, a soft landing if he didn't go out fighting. And then someone leaked the whole story to me anyway. But I think it just sort of shows the level of dysfunction at the top parts of this company. And for me, it was just sort of trying to step back and be like, all right, what's the story? How do I do it? And present it in a way where I'm not taking anyone's sides. Because again, I have no ill will towards any of these people. It's more just sort of a rich story and human behavior and sort of betrayal and drama at the very top of a valuable company.
Uber was and remains a very powerful company. It began with arguably a good idea. It was on the vanguard of this new gig economy, for better or worse, and it disrupted an entrenched industry, taxis. In your opinion, were Uber's aggressive culture and tactics necessary for that growth and success? Was there a better way to simultaneously fend off competition, overcome regulation, and innovate like they did, but without an internal culture that rewarded this Visigoth behavior?
I think about this a lot too. And I think in Silicon Valley, like, look, the history of Silicon Valley is basically seeing what norms are, seeing incumbent companies or industries and overturning them, right? And, you know, that happened with PayPal, that happened with now we're in this sort of banking and cryptocurrency revolution where people want to sort of upend the financial system. That happened with social networking. Everything before was sort of like destroyed and raised by Facebook, and now they sort of dominate. And so transportation seemed sort of ripe for disruption by the time that Uber came around. And frankly, you know, I lived in San Francisco back in 2009, 2010, when I couldn't get a cab and when Muni and the transportation system was not working all the time. And it was really a welcome and great idea when it first came. I think the thing that tech doesn't think about as often are the consequences and sort of repercussions that it means for the rest of the economy and the rest of the business world when a new disruptive sector comes into play. And that really showed up in the taxi industry, just sort of caving in on itself, taxi medallions going to a fraction of what their value was in the past, and people losing their jobs and livelihoods and eventually, you know, committing suicide in serious numbers because of their livelihoods going to nothing, essentially. So I think that something that tech needs to sort of reckon with is, I agree that disruption can be a good thing, but, you know, also sort of taking into account some of the consequences around it and being compassionate to those that are going through it as a result of this. Do I think Uber could have been Uber were it any other, let's say, more upstanding company or at least less sort of brazenly, willing to flout laws and rules? I don't know. I really, you know, a lot of folks in tech would say asking permission will not get you anywhere. Just asking forgiveness is how to do it. And I don't think anyone at the top of Uber, at least a few years ago, would say that they could have done it any other way. But I do think it's spurred a sort of sea change around, you know, how founders behave now. And young founders of would-be tech startups have come up to me on book tours back when life was normal and said, I want to found a next great company, but do it the right way, essentially, and not do it like this, pointing at my book and pointing at Travis's behavior. And so I'm very curious what the next generation of companies reacting to this kind of like sort of bad behavior in Silicon Valley, what that's going to look like.
Yeah, certainly there's a lot of power in disruption, and it reverberates well beyond just the immediate stakeholders of the disrupting business. But even within Uber, there's clearly a bunch of power to be had and shared. But one person who didn't share too much of it was Travis. He consolidated a lot of power, as you mentioned in your book. So at the top, not just the figurehead, but a co-founder and CEO and immensely influential, is Travis really to blame for Uber's early trajectory?
I mean, look, I think you can't look at it without the sort of culture of enablement on everyone around Travis. And everyone was really comfortable with the way things were going when they thought that they were going to be billionaires and when Travis was making the valuation go up and up and up and they were raising more money. You know, one thing Travis would tell people in so many words is, look, I'm going to make you rich. You know, I'm going to make me building this company, doing it the way I do. you're going to be wealthy beyond what you could have thought of. So just chill out and let me do it. And I think that worked for a long time. And people sort of suddenly growing big warning signs or worries around the warning signs when things were going south. I have just a little bit of skepticism around that. And I think culpability can go much farther than just Travis. But at the end of the day, CEO is CEO, and for better or worse, they do have to essentially answer for a lot of it. I do also think that like boards and the way that boards are structured are very important and can contribute to dysfunction, if not really a good counterbalance to executive power. And this was a real example of the board having no power over its CEO, especially when it was too late.
Well, let's talk about the board. The board of directors, you know, usually has a fiduciary responsibility to the shareholders, but you know, shareholders aren't the only stakeholders. They're the customers and employees too, and you know, the community at large. Was Uber's board a good steward for all of these groups?
It's funny because Bill Gurley, who was one of the board members, one of the early VCs who got into Uber early, a legendary figure in Silicon Valley now, his real drumbeat has been our board's responsibility is to its shareholders. We need to fulfill our fiduciary duty. And the way Uber was operating in the end, we cannot say in good conscience that we're doing that because Travis being there essentially is tanking the value of the company. I think he ultimately believed that he did the right thing in leading this sort of investor coup against Travis. I think in Silicon Valley culture, taking out your founder, removing the CEO is sort of the cardinal sin of any VC. And every VC firm likes to say they're founder friendly to attract the next startups or whatever. So, and that move was still controversial. There's startup and VC people that I talk to that think Bill and the other investors should not have done that. But I think they felt they were doing the right thing. I also think that, you know, like for a long time, the board was basically just a box checking department for Travis and just sort of let him sort of do his thing and didn't look too hard at some of the behaviors when everything was going right and going smoothly. I mean, as long as the graph is going up and to the right, you're gaining more users, your revenue is exploding, and your valuation is surging, I don't think anyone really wants to rock the boat. But I agree, there's real questions around should the board have been involved earlier in some of the behaviors. And, you know, to be fair to the board, how much were they let in on what was going on at Uber and how forthcoming was Travis around some of the activity? So there's real questions around how much they knew or didn't know, basically.
There's one board member in particular who was one of Travis's closest ally, Arianna Huffington. It's at least surprising, if not ironic, that Travis's biggest defender was a woman. What role did Arianna play in Travis's success and then maybe his ultimate demise?
Yeah, Arianna's an amazing character for the book and then just in real life. She's sort of a force of nature. She's been around to be a part of a lot of different sea changes in tech. Huffington Post obviously was one of the first to really get the power of the internet long before the Times or other publications did. And, you know, she was smart enough to make her way onto the board of Uber early on. I think she has an amazing sense for where power lies and how to hold on to it. And so for a very long time, she realized, I think she was actually friendly with Travis, actually liked Travis, and became a sort of mentor-like figure for him for a long time, and then ultimately a maternal figure when Travis's mother passed away tragically and unexpectedly. So she was one of his close allies for a long period of time, especially when he was in power and it didn't look like he was going anywhere. But I think she also sensed where the tide was turning when he was sort of famously taken out by this investor coup. And instead of staying on his side until the very end, she sensed that this guy's time is short and she needs to get on the other side of it. So ultimately she suggested to him, I think you should step down, and kind of sided with the investors there. And, you know, in retrospect, I think Travis felt a huge betrayal by Arianna, this woman who was supposedly standing by him for so long, in the end ended up being in favor of just staying in control. And I think he still carries that now. People I talk to that are close to him notes that his relationship is complicated because she was a longtime ally and then when he needed it the most, felt like he was betrayed. So it's very complicated, but I think she is an amazing business sense, an amazing sense of power and where the tide is turning.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Well, let's talk about Uber's life after Travis. So after Travis left the company, did Uber turn it around? What does the future hold for Uber, the company?
Yeah, I mean, after this very dramatic ousting of him and, him trying to sort of place a kind of a puppet-like CEO inside of the company and then ultimately going a different direction, they nominated and elected Dara Khosrowshahi, the former CEO of Expedia, to be the CEO of Uber. It's been a few years since then. Dara has had it's been a rough few years, honestly. They were supposed to be this sort of record-breaking IPO and ended up being probably a real turning point for private companies going public and expectations being really deflated in how that was happening. You know, Uber was supposed to be valued in public markets at $100 billion, $120 billion. And they basically didn't even rise above its opening share price that day. And it was one of the worst IPOs in recent history, if not much longer. So it became this sort of moment where I think Uber realized that it had a lot of living up to its hype to do. And so Dara had to come in and sort of cut a lot of the profligate spending that they were doing. A lot of their huge bets on autonomous are now no longer even in play. They've shut down different branches of its bike and scooter sharing thing, where they spent at least $100 million on acquiring a company to do that. They've really sort of trimmed down to get to a sense of a profitable company, because Dara really was hired to be, he's less about the sort of like sky high dreamer type that Travis was, and more this is the adult in the room CEO who can get Uber to being profitable. They're still not there. I think the pandemic really hammered Uber, just because people aren't taking Ubers in great numbers like they were when we weren't quarantined. But Uber Eats is still their bright spot, and they're investing in this food delivery business, which is growing a lot, obviously, because of how people are ordering food now these days. So I wouldn't say they're down and out, but I think they really had a humbling few years after the IPO and after Travis. And one source of mine I've talked to in the past thinks about the post-Travis period under Dara, and this person says, you know, is Uber going to be the next Amazon, or is it going to be the next eBay? And by that, he means, you know, is it going to be this world-changing, inspiring company, or is it going to be sort of a rote, you know, afterthought in the history of technology and, you know, a fine business and maybe even a profitable business, but nothing that's going to inspire the next generation of entrepreneurs? And I think that question is still open.
Well, it's still an open question about Travis, too. How did he fare in the IPO?
Travis, you know, this is a funny thing. Like, you know, he got taken out and sort of has left the board, really has nothing to do with Uber in the day-to-day anymore, but he's still a billionaire. You know, he made quite a bit of money in the IPO and gone on to create a different startup of his own doing in the food delivery space on these things called ghost kitchens, which are also really interesting and sort of growing now. and still has an attachment to ride hailing because there's a delivery element to the food preparation of ghost kitchen. So he's never quite fully unattached. But I think the question for a while was, is he going to be accepted into polite society anymore? Or is he going to be this outcast? And he's done this thing where he's sort of gone under the radar, definitely doesn't want the attention of press like he used to have all the time, and is trying to, I think, do a sort of rehabbing of his career. But he's still, he's still accepted into polite society. He's still going to the Met Galas of the world and enjoying himself in private trips to the islands and stuff. So I wouldn't say he's exactly hurting. He's just sort of being much lower key than he used to be.
In one interview with another reporter, Travis predicted that, having spent time with him, that the reporter is going to be asked if Travis is an asshole. So I was wondering, in your final analysis, is Travis Kalanick an asshole, or is he just misunderstood?
I think he would say you kind of have to be an asshole in the world that he worked in. You're going up against quote-unquote taxi cartels, sometimes literally the mafia, in a number of different markets that have cornered it. And nice guys can sometimes finish last in these games where you're trying to sort of win over the hearts and minds and markets of the transportation industry. I don't think he thinks of himself as an asshole. I think he feels like he has to play an asshole. But I don't know. I would say we are defined by our actions, not our sort of words or motivations. So I'm very curious where his career goes now that he's sort of got Uber behind him and is trying to turn over a new leaf. I talk to folks now who say he's the same Travis. And, he was in his 40s when all the Uber stuff was going on, and he's kind of decided who he was. And perhaps what made him a great hard-charging CEO is also this sort of hamartia that will never leave him. And maybe he just is who he is at this point. So take that for what it's worth.
Even despite the scandal, Uber's growth and potential is undeniable. A lot of the company of what the company has achieved is admirable and can be inspiring to other entrepreneurs. But let's forget about Travis's foibles and the excess and missteps. What did Uber do right? What should the business person of today look to emulate in the Uber story?
The most basic part of it, I think, is just looking at markets that have grown stagnant or stale. I mean, the taxi industry pre-Uber had not changed in years, and they had no reason to. Incumbents, when in power for a long period of time, tend to sort of get complacent. And I think complacency is the area that entrepreneurs thrive in. So being able to identify those spots, really keeping your eyes open in the world around you and seeing where there are shortcomings and where you could improve it. I think young entrepreneurs or sort of would-be entrepreneurs really look at the world and see possibility and the potential for change rather than just sort of going with the flow. So Uber's greatest sort of trick was seeing this underserved market and tapping into it and just hitting it as hard as they could, because they knew once you have a great idea, someone else might have it very quickly afterwards, if not at the same time. So they moved on it very fast and just sort of exploited the hell out of it, basically.
Well, Mike Isaac, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was great.
That was my conversation with Mike Isaac, a New York Times technology correspondent and author of Super Pumped, The Battle for Uber, a best-selling book now available in paperback at Amazon and wherever books are sold. On the next season of Business Movers, the legend of John DeLorean. The name DeLorean isn't just synonymous with the 1985 blockbuster film Back to the Future. It's also infamous for its connection to two uniquely American innovations, the sports car and the drug trade. Automobile maker John DeLorean's genius led him to the heights of the American auto industry and into the depths of a criminal underworld. Hey, Prime members. You can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. From Wondery, this is Episode 5 of The Rise and Fall of Uber for Business Movers. A quick note about our reenactments. In most cases, we can't know everything that happened. but all our dramatizations are based on historical research. If you'd like to learn more about Uber, be sure to pick up Mike Isaac's book, Super Pumped, The Battle for Uber, now in paperback. Business Movers is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Barrett. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode was produced by Stephen Walters. Executive producers are Stephen Walters for Ritual Productions and Jenny Lauer Beckman and Marshall Louie for Wondery.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Takeoff 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.